Hello and welcome to What About Us? Cultural Awareness in Clinical Practice. I'm Kate Cooper and today we're joined by Dr. Jo Daniels, who's a senior lecturer and the academic director for the Doctorate in Clinical Psychology at the University of Bath. Now, for the episode this week, we wanted to expand the conversation about diversity in clinical psychology and to talk about class. So today, Jo Daniels will be talking about her experience of being from a working class background and being a practitioner in clinical psychology. So over to the interview. So we're joined today by Dr. Jo Daniels, and we're going to talk about her experiences of diversity in the clinical psychology profession. So welcome, Jo.
Thank you.
I just wanted to start by asking you, what experiences of yours drew you to be a guest on this podcast?
I guess I feel like issues relating to class or socioeconomic status aren't talked about enough. And I think it's where there's a lot of growth in other areas of diversity, where we have really open discussions around things that feel very visible, such as gender, race. I think issues relating to background diversity, I think, aren't talked about very much. And it feels like these are really important issues that should be spoken about as well in terms of context, particularly because I think it's not well represented in our profession.
That's super helpful. And I'm so glad that you did. You are being a guest on the podcast today, because I agree that it's really important we do talk about this. And I wondered, do you have any thoughts about why this isn't a difference that's being talked about in the profession at the moment?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think partly it's really invisible. And I think the issues that need talking about, such as stigma and internalised shame and having, you know, people having to compromise their identity, are the issues that are invisible. So I think with coming from a different background in a profession that is predominantly middle class, I think you have a choice where, because I'm from what I would term as a working class background myself, and I think there's a choice that you have to make where you either, you know, stay in yourself and you'll, you know, sort of really connect with your roots and it becomes quite clear that you're from a different background, or you try and merge into the middle class, or, you know, try and fit in, and by doing so you do compromise sometimes who you are. So I think it's the fact that it's really difficult, it's really challenging, and it's not very visible, that difference, because I think a lot of us from a working class background feel the need to fit in and to not draw attention to it. So therefore, you know, the minute you draw attention to it, you're also exposing yourself in some ways, because I think it feels really important to honour your roots. And we do talk a lot about that in clinical psychology, is trying to be authentic and congruent. And that's certainly what we teach. And, you know, it forms part of our therapy, and that unconditional positive regard. But when it comes to something like this, and I'm sure that class is not exclusive to class. I imagine that it is to some of these, you know, other diverse groups. But for me, it's very palpable that you sort of have to make that decision. Are you going to make it obvious, or are you going to pretend it's not there? And I think that can make you feel a little guilty as well. So I think there's a real incongruence that you live with that makes it invisible. But also I think there's things like, you know, really really noticeable differences. So people from working class backgrounds, they may not necessarily have a gap year, or they may talk differently, or, you know, and I think these things can make you feel really different. Nobody wants to really feel different. Nobody really likes to talk about financial hardship. In some ways that's considered vulgar, you know. So a lot of the issues associated with coming from a more difficult background in terms of socioeconomic status are things that people don't want to talk about because it makes them feel really uncomfortable.
And it's so interesting listening to you talk about that. I'm reminded of previous episodes of the podcast when we've had people from different cultural backgrounds talk about that kind of assimilation into the profession of clinical psychology and maybe having to use a very different style of communication or a different style of language when working in clinical settings in order to kind of get by and be taken seriously, really. And again, that kind of betrayal of their cultural identity. So it's so interesting to hear you talk about that in terms of class identity. And I guess I was really intrigued. I'm wondering what strategies have you used having this kind of working class background, and you talked about kind of the assimilation. What strategies have you used in your career?
You mean to make it less visible?
Yeah, or how have you dealt with having this difference that other people might not know about? How have you navigated that? Have you used different kind of approaches over the years, and how has that gone?
Yeah, so I think I read a little bit around this before I came on, and also I've been aware there's some other discussions going on in clinical psychology around the challenges of working class, and I've been really interested to see what other people have done as well. And what one thing I took away from what I've read is that people from working class background do have an inherent sense of self-determinism and a really strong work ethic. And that's not to say that people from other groups don't have that, but it feels like a defining feature, because, you know, if you to define it really clearly, working class is where you only have your labour to sell, and that you don't have any other means of generating income. And so I think to me, that self-determinism really defines who I am. And it wasn't until recently I realised that actually that's probably where that's come from. That's probably the origin of the really strong work ethic, and that's all you've got, really. And so you need to go for it. And I think there's a really pivotal point for me where I'd finished my undergraduate degree, and I very much relied on finances from the state. And, you know, I've heard sort of more difficult stories than mine, my background. But for me, you know, as soon as I finished my undergraduate degree, I lived in a council flat and survived on benefits until I got a job. And I can't imagine there's that many people in my profession now that can say they experienced something like that. And, you know, I didn't really have very much. But I was really determined to get on to training, because that's what I lived for, really. But I remember applying to training and speaking to a particular program that I'd been rejected from, and they said to me, well, you know, to be honest, because you've got a degree from where you got it from, you're going to need a master's degree. And I was really angry because I had gone to the university that I had because I had no idea how to choose a university as the first person in my family. I went for a university that was in a nice place because that's what I valued. And I had no idea that was going to affect the rest of my life. So when I got to I thought that self-determinism came out, and I thought, I'm not accepting that. That's not okay. That's not okay as a barrier, that I refuse to be refused to access my dream that I've worked so hard for, and for other people to be advantaged because of finances. And I made my mind up then that there's no way I was not going to get onto clinical psychology training. So I think the thing that's driven me through is, you know, that refusal, really, that self-determinism, that I must push forward and I must work hard. And I did, and I eventually got there, but it wasn't easy, and I didn't get straight on, and, you know, I didn't come from a good university background. But there's been other smaller things, like the way that I talk is definitely different from how it was before. You know, often I'm in my telephone voice depending on who I'm talking to, and I won't necessarily have drawn attention to certain facts or parts of my background. But I think it isn't until I've become more experienced and more senior that I've felt comfortable to say, actually, this is a badge of honour. This isn't, you know, I shouldn't be ashamed of this. I should be helping other people to see, you know, I should be visible so that other people can think that this is a profession that welcomes people from a diverse background from this angle as well. But I think for me, I just worked really very, very hard and tried to detract from anything, as we all do really, that made me look different, and tried not to expose myself as being from a different background. But it's always been there. It's really palpable. It's only now at a point in my life where I think actually this is about diversity, and while I'm embracing it in other groups, I need to embrace it in myself as well, and recognize that actually coming from this background, it also brings a lot of benefits in this profession.
Yeah, and it's totally understandable that there was a point in your career where it felt like less possible to talk about that difference. And now that you're in a position where you're more senior and you have more of a platform that you can talk about it more, I guess there's a couple of things I want to ask, but I just wanted to go back to, what was it like for you, that experience of maybe trying to hide that difference when you were earlier in your career?
It was just really uncomfortable. It feels like you're less credible. And I guess that's the difference now, being experienced, is that I've demonstrated my credibility to a degree, you know. But back then, I think it just felt like there was a lack of equity, that I felt like I had to do more to get where I wanted to be. Whereas I was seeing other people sailing past me, and I thought, that's not about, you know, intelligence particularly, which it felt like it should be, that there was, you know, I'm a firm believer in a sort of meritocracy, that people should get ahead based on their efforts and work. And I guess it felt like I was always having to work that little bit harder, and that in some way I wasn't okay or good enough. And I think it gives that message that you're not quite the same, you're not quite good enough. And actually it's much more complicated than that. But I think at that time in my life, I didn't really have a framework around it. I didn't really understand. It was only until recently that I thought, actually, that's what that was about for me. But in the same way, that anger that I felt when that person said, and I remember it so acutely, I was actually in a dressing room in a shop trying something on when I got the call. It was really a pivotal moment, and I just got so angry and I refused. And I think that's that, all of that anger, feeling like there was a lack of equality, that's when that came out and really drove me on, really. But it's not a pleasant feeling to be othered in that way.
Absolutely. And I'm just wondering, I mean, you talked about, you know, society should be a meritocracy. I totally agree with you. I'm wondering, aside from like wide scale societal overhaul, whether there are any small things that helped you along the way, or that could have been different, that would have helped you at that phase.
I mean, I think obviously I didn't have finances at my disposal, and I know that would have made a huge, significant difference, or having parents from a more educated background to help inform my university choices, or, you know, the kinds of extracurricular things that I could have done that have made me appear more well-rounded, and, you know, all of these attractive qualities. So I think that lack of knowledge of the academic world, I think, feels really important. I had no idea what they were expecting. I thought, and again, it was really identifying with that working class ethic, I thought that if I just worked really, really hard, I would get there, you know. And so I think, yeah, I think it's mainly that. I think the financial support, and also the support of putting that in place where somebody's able to tell me the kinds of things I needed to say and the kinds of things I needed to do. And I do that now, and I mentor a number of people who are trying to get into, you know, assistant roles or clinical psychology, and I look over their CVs and I look over the application forms and draw out what they actually, the strengths of their experience, because I think you're sort of taught to hide it rather than bring out the benefits of coming from a background that's a little bit different. I mean, there's so much more that can be brought out in terms of strengths, and, you know, and I think if I'd have had that, I think that mentorship that I'm offering to others, or trying to offer to others, I think that would have been a huge, made a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've just made me think as well that the school you go to and the education that you have up until the age of 18 has a huge impact on the way that you kind of talk about your experience, not only on the actual experiences that you get because of the connections that you have, but also the way you talk about that experience. And I think, yeah, depending on your background, there are groups of people who are taught to be very confident and really put their achievements at the front, and then there are other groups that are taught to almost do the opposite, and that can have a profound effect on what the way that people present the experience that they have in their CV. So that sounds brilliant, the work that you're doing to help people who are in a similar position to the one that you were in. I guess I wanted to ask about, so now that you are in, you do have lots of experience, you're in a much more senior position at a university, what has it been like being a bit more open about your background with colleagues?
I guess I'm not that open, but my intention is different now. So I'm not that open because I don't want to lead with that, because it doesn't define me. So I'm not, I suppose I don't talk about it very much, but if it's relevant, that's when it comes into the conversation. And it still feels a little bit uncomfortable. But I remember only a few years ago, a colleague of mine mentioned something about their childhood that sounded like their family really didn't have very much money. And they were talking about it really openly. And I was really taken aback. And I was really impressed that they were able to do that. And I'm thinking, I really wish I could do that. And I'm able to do that now. And in the same way that person didn't talk about it all the time, neither do I. It's part of who I am, but we're all so complex that, you know, we show different facets at different times. So I don't talk about it very much, in the sense that somebody from a middle class background wouldn't necessarily talk about it that much either. But I guess what I do try and do is to sit with that discomfort and not let it sway me in any direction, not let it moderate or censor my experience or my conversation. So, or if somebody else is talking to me about their background, particularly if it's a trainee or a student, or if, you know, particularly if they're facing difficulty, then I do then try and show some shared experience and validation, you know, without taking away from them, obviously. But for me, I think it's now about acknowledging that as part of who I am, and being comfortable to talk about it if and when it's appropriate. But
And you mentioned you would kind of maybe share your experiences with a trainee if it would be helpful for them. I wonder, does your background influence your work in any other ways?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't, it's not an area that I research. I mean, I think I always make sure that we take these things into account. So I guess I've got an awareness in my research of accounting for issues associated with financial hardship. When I'm doing my research, I think it's really important to gather all of the relevant data and to interpret it in a broad context. I think context is really essential. So I suppose in that way, I'm more aware than I may have been of the broader context. I think where it influenced me most, and this is going back to what the benefits are of coming from my background, is that I can really connect with my patients sometimes on a really different level. So I remember one particular patient where she'd come from she's in real hardship, and she was a single parent and was really struggling. And, you know, she was sort of saying, my mental health isn't my biggest problem right now. The fact that I don't have any electricity at home, that's my biggest problem right now. And how are you going to help with that? And I really feel that acutely. You know, I really can connect with what that's like, and how it's important to not say, yeah, but we're going to talk about mental health right now, because context is so powerful. So I suppose it really influences that work, because I feel like I've got an understanding that I wouldn't have had. And then I also bring that I'd like to think I bring that optimism and hope in some degree. And while I don't talk about it in my therapy, I get a really strong sense that my patients, I don't know, have a sense of it, that that I'm not in an ivory tower, that I'm a human being as well, and that I have may have shared experiences, but that my focus remains on them.
That's a really positive message, and I'm really glad to hear that. I wondered if you had any advice to people who are in a similar position to the one you were in early in your career and who want to get into the profession of clinical psychology. Is there anything that you wish you'd known at that time?
That's such a difficult question, because it's so easy for me in my position now to just say, keep going. But it's not that easy. It's really hard. And there are people who are in a much more difficult position than I was, for sure. I think what did help me along was hearing people somewhere along the line saying, keep going, just keep working, keep going. So, and I guess I have to give that message, is if you really want this, please keep going. But also, I think, find someone who can mentor you. And if you don't know someone, approach a training program, because I really have confidence in my colleagues, and I really think that if people were able to reach out, then I think we should be able to help. I'd like to, you know, I spy that there's one day some more formal mechanism that we can support people, but just find somebody who believes in you, whether it's a supervisor of, you know, a clinical psychology supervisor or a research supervisor or support in a support worker role. And I think be open as much as you can, as much as you're comfortable on the application forms for clearinghouse, because, you know, speaking as a program member, we do read into these things, we do see these things. And even, you know, roles like support worker roles or nursing assistant roles, you know, the more messy roles, that's really important experience. So try not too much, I think, to compromise who you are, because I think that authenticity is really vital. So I think it's around that, and whoever, find someone who believes in you, and try and believe in yourself, I guess.
That is so helpful, and I'm sure so many of our listeners are going to find that incredibly useful advice, whether they're from a working class background or from another diverse background, that we don't see enough people of in the profession. And so, and especially as you do work on a DClin programme, I think that will be really valuable for many people.
Thank you so much to Jo for taking the time to talk to us on the podcast today. So we'll be back in November for another episode, so do tune in then. That's all for now. Thank you and goodbye.